Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at Facebook.com/RadioCafe. Later in the program, we'll be speaking to Jonathan Harrell. He's a scholar of New Mexican and Mexican history, language, and music. I'm happy now to welcome to the program Deb Hikes. She is the writer and performer of The White Trash Monologue, which opens this weekend. It's running April 1st and 2nd, Friday and Saturday, and then the following weekend at the Rail Yard Performance Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. Now, I've read the script, seen some of the rehearsal, and this is your life story or some theatrical version of your life story coming from you call it the white trash monologue, poor white family, fundamentalist mother, military father, and not a whole lot of loving kindness.
No, there wasn't a whole lot of loving kindness or culture. We were very devoid of things in the outside world, such as movies and theater and vacations. We didn't even go on vacations. So it was very isolated in a lot of ways.
You were in Pennsylvania?
Yes, York, Pennsylvania.
How did you decide to make your story at this point in your life into a theatrical monologue?
Well, actually, I was looking to go back into therapy. And I was looking around for a therapist, and I couldn't find anybody that worked quite like the way I wanted to do therapy. So I saw Tanya Taylor Rubenstein, who is my director. She does one person monologues, and I saw her advertisement on the back of the reporter, and I thought, now that sounds like something I can get into. So the journey began about a year and a half ago, creating this show, and it developed over time.
What was it actually like to go back and remember all the things that you've been through, which, judging from the writing in this, was really not that much fun to live through the first time, much less to relive?
Well, as in any therapy, a lot of times it is about going back and reliving some difficult times. And doing it in performance mode gave me the option of making it a little bit more theatrical and having some fun with it also. So there was a balance. There was a lot of hard feeling, you know, difficult feelings. There was anger that came up and sadness, and there was a lot of gratitude also. So to go back and revisit it, I do have some distance because of the work I've already done in therapy in the past. So it wasn't as tough as if I was just going in without any other healing in my life.
Right. Would you like to tell us about some of the people in your family? A little preview of the show?
Well, I play my mother and my father in the show, and two of my sisters and one of my brothers. I graciously left out one brother and one sister. There's actually six of us total in the family, children-wise. My father was a World War II veteran. And that's pretty much all of his life was work and the memories of war. And so I play him in the monologue, and I don't want to give too much away him. My mother, as you had mentioned before, was a fundamentalist Christian, and that has been, I'd say, 99% of her focus in her life. I was telling someone the other day that she actually never, that I know of, read a book except for the Bible in her life, and she is 76 years old. So she shows up pretty strongly. She wore the pants in the family and was a disciplinarian. And loved professional wrestling. And still does to this day. Professional wrestling and baseball. And that's really interesting. Yes, my father does not like sports. My mother holds that part. And I do play my oldest sister. She lives in Tennessee. And she is 60 years old and very overweight and has a lot of her own issues, which I bring out in a comical sort of way in this show. I also play my younger brother and younger sister also. And my younger brother is an ex-Marine and also has a history of alcoholism, as I do also. I've been sober 17 years. And he has quite a comical dating story about a date that he met on one of these internet sites.
And ladies and gentlemen, it is quite unbelievable. And if you want to hear about it, you will have to go to the show.
And then my younger sister also, she, well, let's put it this way. She has an anger issue. And so some of that shows up in the monologue in a comical way also. I really wanted this show not just to be funny, because there's a lot of funny things out there, white trash, a lot of movies and sitcoms. I wanted this one to come in and also have a heart. So that's part of the big reason I wrote this.
It's interesting because when we were talking, I was at your rehearsal and you said you haven't told your family that you're doing this because they wouldn't understand, but for you it's a way of honoring them.
Yes, yes. I really wrote this show from my heart. It's not to get back at them. It's not out of anger, resentment. This is a lot. My family has not been able to really tell their story in their life. They're just very secluded, isolated, and shut down in a lot of ways. And I really wanted to honor them. And this show is definitely from my heart.
Now, it did make me think about a number of things. One of them, for example, fundamentalist Christianity for somebody like your mother is the best thing in her life.
Yes.
And for people who come from, let's say, violence or lack of love or lack of community or just pure loneliness, that sense of having a place where you can go and where you are immediately accepted is huge.
Yes. You know, I used to be very anti-religion, and the more I've got to know my mother's story over the years, and even more so with this show, my heart is softened around organized religion also, because I do see that there's a place for it in people's lives that give them hope and gives them a place and a sense of community. I see that in my mother, that her whole life is built around church, and it has been her sense of community and belonging on the planet.
Now, how, if I may ask, did you get out? How did you end up here in New Mexico? You became a therapist.
Yes. Well, 17 years ago, I was suicidal, and I decided I was either going to kill myself or change my life. So I went to therapy. And several months later, I got sober, and I had been drinking 17 years. And so after I got sober, all my friends still wanted to offer me drinks, and, you know, the environment was the same. And I thought, in order to survive this and to stay sober, I felt a huge inspiration to move out of the state and start somewhere fresh.
And that's a problem for so many people who get sober, is if they don't change their environment, it's so hard to change your life.
Yes, yes. And I wanted to survive. I wanted to do something totally different. So a friend of mine was moving back to New Mexico, and I quit my job, and I came out here with a friend of mine, and I've been here for 17 years. Yes, that's how I made it to New Mexico.
And you became a therapist as a result of the process that began with sobriety?
Well, it was my first interaction with a therapist, and she basically saved my life. I mean, she was an amazing woman. And when I moved here, it wasn't in my forefront consciousness that I wanted to be a therapist. I did a lot of other jobs here, and I really had a pull to go back to school. Nobody in my family has graduated college or went on to go to college. So something inside of me knew that this was my calling. So I ended up going to the College of Santa Fe was open. I went there for my bachelor's, and then I went to Southwestern College for my master's.
When you work with people as a therapist, how does your background with all the things that you've suffered and all the crazy stuff you've been through, how does it help you do your work?
Well, I feel very empathetic with my clients and compassionate. I feel like I've walked somehow, not directly in their shoes, of course, because everybody's experience is different of life, but I do feel like I have a feeling of where they're at, and I'm more able to guide them and support them in their healing process, because in some ways, shape, or form, I've been there.
We're talking to Deb Hykus about her upcoming performance called The White Trash Monologue. Another thing that I was thinking about was, with the kind of social problems that you describe, that in the news and the media get described in a sort of politicized or clinical way, but in your monologue, it brings out, you know, the problems of violence and lack of love and lack of culture, as you talk about, in such a personal, familial way, and it seems like these are generations-old patterns that are hard to break. And when you think of the social system that we're living in and what could be done to make, not only, I mean, you got yourself out by the grace of God, yeah, or dog, yeah, or whatever, right, you want to call it. but what, I mean, how could your life have been better? What interventions, school or whatever, would you have liked to have had as a child?
Well, as a child, I wouldn't even have been thinking about it, but I know as a teenager, because I love working with adolescents now, and when I look back, I really wish I would have had one figure, one role model in my life as a teenager that could have helped support and guide me, because, of course, I was living out my family's life, you know, the addiction and the violence and just the acting out in general, with no healthy adult around to guide me. So that's one piece that I would say about our society also, is to have support at a younger age, because we're dealing with so much addiction that if we can catch it in the families, you know, as a family system, and work with it, I believe that would help keep people out of prison and less addiction. Because I do believe people are searching. I do believe that we all have a healthy part of us, a major healthy part. But without support, it can't be grown and nurtured.
The thing that you hint at in the, or that you say, not an explicit way, but it's all there in your show, is that if the people, for example, just in your family, had been given half a chance, they would have been artists, math teachers, writers. There's a lot of talent there going to waste.
Wow, that's a huge topic. I was just saying that to someone the other day. I said, I think my family is a family of artists who haven't had a chance. I remember back, it was we were going to church when we were kids, and we actually created and put on the whole Christmas play, and it wasn't the Christmas story. We made up a whole Christmas play, and I remember I was actually had a minimal part. I was the snow thrower at the window, but my sister and brothers all played parts in that theatrical production, and they got a standing ovation. So I have a family of improvers, and when we get together as a family, as a like at a reunion or something, they have me in stitches the whole time, because they would have been great stand-up comedians. And yes, my younger sister is an artist. I mean, I cannot believe what she can draw and paint, and she didn't take that route. And my oldest sister, she could have been a scholar. Brilliant. She read every book. I swear she would read and read and read and read. And she took the route of having kids and moving to Tennessee and continuing the white trash lifestyle. And my mother, I say I take after my mother a lot, because she gets up and preaches in church, and she's very outspoken and gregarious. And she missed her calling also on stage, because she would have been a magnificent performer. She has a lot of chutzpah. Yes.
Very interesting. Well, Deb Heikes is the writer and performer of the White Trash Monologue, which once again opens this weekend. It's Friday and Saturday, April 1st and 2nd, and then again the following weekend, the 8th and 9th, at 7:30 at the Rail Yard Performance Center right here in Santa Fe, directed by Tanya Taylor Rubenstein. For more information, you can call, and for tickets, you can call 982-8309. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Shirley. I really appreciate this.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Jonathan Harrell. He's an independent scholar specializing in Mexican and New Mexican history, language, culture. He's a teacher of heritage language, and he's going to be speaking at the annual conference of the Rocky Mountain Council for Latin American Studies, which is happening at the Hotel Santa Fe, on the 6th through the 9th of April. That's coming up soon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you have written a paper on a rebellion that happened in 1837, which we're going to be talking about in a moment. This, your work, basically, you started in New Mexico, you're from New Mexico, but you're looking at the interconnections between and among Mexico, New Mexico, and other Latin American countries. How did you get interested in all of that?
I think it was probably because of my upbringing. I've always looked for interconnectedness because I sort of have always had to. My mother's a native New Mexican. She's from Española, New Mexico. My father's from South Louisiana. So growing up was always kind of this crossing of borders, linguistic borders, cultural borders, things like that. So I think I always had a tendency to look at things in a larger picture, or at least try to see things in a larger picture. So that's always been a theme of my life, I guess, and of my research as well.
Let's talk about 1837. What happened in New Mexico at that time?
At that time, there's one of the most violent rebellions, the Pueblo Revolt notwithstanding, that takes place in New Mexico. What happens at that time is there's this uprising, this tension that's underlying kind of every level of society that has is basically caused by neglect from the central government, is exacerbated by punitive campaigns that people are forced to go and participate in against raiding Navajo and raiding nomadic tribes, and the establishment of centralism in the central government, which effectively takes away a good deal of autonomy from the local provinces, the threat of increased taxation, a new governor who's an outsider. He's no longer from New Mexico or from Chihuahua or Durango. They send him all the way from Mexico City. He doesn't know the customs. A lot of people take their frustrations that they have with the central government out on him. He sort of becomes this scapegoat. He's in the wrong place at the wrong time. There's this huge rebellion that erupts. They kill him. They cut his head off. They kill 16 of his government officials.
They leave him in the middle of the road.
They leave him in the road to rot. They cut his head off, and they take it on a pike to the rebel camp, kick it around like a football. They're hurling curses and all these things against his dead body. They torture his officials. There's all these horrible things that happen because of this frustration that just reaches a boiling point at that time.
Now, this is a rebellion against central government. So at this time, New Mexico is under the control of essentially Mexico City, mm-hmm. as are provinces all around, I mean, hundreds, really thousands of miles.
That's correct. And there's a tremendous lack of communication between the provinces and Mexico City. We're looking at a period where instability is the norm. In the period between 1821, when Mexico achieves its independence from Spain, up until 1837, there's something like 21 different changes in the executive office in Mexico City, most of which have come about because of violence. There's revolts everywhere at this time. The most famous one is probably Texas, because we get the Alamo, the Battle of the Alamo and all of that. But there's rebellions breaking out as early as 1835 in Zacatecas, and as late as the 1840s in Yucatan, where Yucatan actually separates from Mexico for a period of time.
And so all of these outlying areas, all of these provinces, may not have had much in common except their rebellion against centralism.
Right. And that's one thing that I've always thought is interesting, is that it's tempting to look at this revolt as a rebellion against Mexico and use it to sort of add fuel to the fire in some of the conflicts that we have now between older families who have been here for a long time and more recent arrivals from Mexico. It's tempting to look at the rebellion and say, well, look, we never really wanted to be a part of Mexico. We were only under Mexican rule for a small amount of time. I tend to look at it as the fact that we were rebelling against the central government makes us even more a part of what was happening in Mexico at that time, because everybody was doing essentially the same thing.
And so was there communication or indeed any kind of alliance among different provinces that were rebelling against the central government of Mexico City?
There were. I think the closer you get to to central Mexico, you do get more communication. There were very clear Federalist movements that were happening in opposition to the centralism, which was very political. Up here, I don't know that the rebellion reached that level of political ideology. I don't know that the rebels were Federalists, necessarily, but they were definitely fighting for their families and for their lifestyles. There was word that reached up here about other rebellions, and you see proclamations made at the time just damning the Texans, you know, not the Anglo Texans, them too, but the Tejanos, the Mexican Texans, who were also in league with the settlers, who also had grievances against the federal government, the central government. We did get news about the rebellion in Zacatecas. In fact, there's a proclamation that Governor Albino Perez, that's the governor who's going to be losing his head in 1837, he makes a proclamation in 1835, shortly after the Zacatecas rebellion is put down, praising the passivity of the New Mexicans. As far as he's concerned, they would never think to do something so horrible as stand up to the central government. 2 years later, they do that very thing, and he loses his life in that rebellion.
What does all of this history that, I mean, I certainly didn't know about it, and I'm by no means a scholar of New Mexican history, but what were the repercussions of that rebellion on New Mexico?
There's they weren't calling it a rebel government, but essentially that's what it was, that gets put into place after the murder of the governor. What my understanding is things just sort of got out of hand. I don't think they necessarily planned on killing the governor, but that's what ended up happening. Such was the aggression that was and the tension that was felt at the time. A man from Taos named Jose Gonzalez is put in the position of governor at that time. Some say he's a Taos Indian. Other people say he's a Genisaro, which is kind of a detribalized Indian, Hispanicized Indian. Others say he was a mestizo. Others say he was criollo. There's a lot of dispute about his ethnic identity. But what's pretty clear is he did not know how to read. And that becomes significant because that's one of the things that he gets attacked for in the press, if you will, in Chihuahua at that time. If you read the newspapers from the 1830s, when they criticize Jose Gonzalez, one of the first things they say is he can't read. They call him an imbecile, he's illiterate, and that's almost worse than anything else that he was doing. So to me, that's very interesting because it shows kind of the rural character of this rebellion. He's a very good representative, I think, of the people who put him in power. His power is short-lived. As soon as he becomes governor, there are several conspiracies to oust him. There's a counterinsurgency that starts gaining momentum almost immediately. Manuel Armijo from Rio Abajo leads that. And troops are sent up from central Mexico and effectively quash the rebellion. So it's pretty short-lived. It's put down right away. And the rebels are immediately villainized in all of the newspapers and also by the first generations of historians that come after that and start to write about it. What I thought was very interesting about it were the songs and the ballads that came out, the expressive culture, the popular culture that comes as a result of this. And it's the way that the community was able to respond to the events.
Well, we have examples of a couple of songs. Tell us about them and what you have found by looking at these songs. First of all, in what form have these songs survived in the first place?
Typically in oral tradition, but also in the case of New Mexico in the written tradition. Rafael Chacon, who was a well-known New Mexican of the 19th century, was a child at the time of the rebellion, and he wrote down some of the verses that he could recall in his memoirs. And that's one way that we've come to know two of the ballads. A third has survived more in the oral tradition. In fact, it's the only one that I'm aware of that was collected by scholars of folklore in the 20th century. It's still being sung and performed as late as the 1940s. You get two differing viewpoints about the events, which I think is pretty interesting. In the selection that we're going to hear, which has been titled Chimayosos Insurgentes, the Insurgents from Chimayo, you get a very, very negative view of the rebels. They're completely villainized. They are accused of being barbarians, of not even having thoughts in their heads, of course not being able to read. The impression that's given is of this almost barbaric horde daring to do battle against the more civilized Mexican army. And that's the selection that we've got to listen to. It's been this particular recording was recorded by Enrique La Madrid, and it is of Cipriano Vigil, well-known folk musician and scholar.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, let's hear that right now.
Chimayosos insurgentes, chaquetas de bayetón, que dejaron los telares por pelear con la nación. Por seducción del coyote formaron revolución, queriendo abrogar las leyes de nuestra constitución. Simples sin conocimientos, no querían que se observara la ley del departamento y se han puesto en un curioso encuentro. Con la fuerza militar nadie se paró formal, todos huyeron al trote, a muchos les ha amargado la seducción del coyote. Murieron los cabecillas de manos de los dragones, muchos y también González, por codicias y ambiciones. Sus malas disposiciones aumentaron sus delitos, llorando los muchachitos han alcanzado el perdón. Vuestra ignorancia, hermanito, formó la revolución.
And we just heard Chimayosos Insurgentes, performed by Cipriano Vigil. And the whole study of New Mexican folk music is something that Cipriano and others have made a huge contribution to our present-day society. And songs like this bring up a real question about living history. To what extent the fact that this is still known and still performed, what does that do to our sense of this time that is 1837?
Absolutely. It keeps the history alive, one thing, and it's it keeps it alive among the people, which lasts a lot longer than something that's that may be written down. So I think it definitely shows a unique perspective on the events. What's interesting about the New Mexico ballads is the differing points of view, because as I mentioned in the song that we just heard, it's very much against the rebels from the point of view of the authorities. There's a third ballad titled Año de 1837, which has not really been recorded, that takes the opposite point of view. Not necessarily the opposite, but takes a more neutral point of view. And instead of trying to villainize the rebels, it's more of a lament. It's lamenting the social breakdown at the time. It's lamenting the fact that the governor has been killed, the district judge has been killed.
Is it an anti-war song?
Maybe you could call it that. It's definitely not trying to assign blame, although it doesn't refrain from kind of wagging a finger at the people who are causing the violence. They're saying, let no one complain when they have to pay for their crimes, basically.
Right.
But at the same time, it's a plea for God, for the Virgin Mary to come and bring peace to the land. It's a plea for unification more than anything. It's a plea for peace. It's a plea for reconciliation and understanding, trying to heal the wounds of this bloody time period. And that one is a very good example of what's known as a decima, which is a composition made up of 10 line verses, which were popular throughout Latin America during the 19th century and are still sung in many parts of Latin America, especially South America, Mexico, the Caribbean. And so it's a good representation of the New Mexican decima.
Now, you have another recording here which we can listen to, which is from Zacatecas. Is it about the same time period?
It's about the same time period. It takes place 2 years before. And
when they had their rebellion.
Exactly.
And the New Mexicans were thought to be too peaceful to ever do something like that, and then they did.
But exactly.
In Zacatecas, they did.
In Zacatecas, they did. This is the first major threat to centralist rule in Mexico. And so for President Santa Anna, who's president at this time, and for all the centralists, it's very important that he gets put down right away, and that they send a clear message to other liberals who would want to challenge centralist rule. What happens is the central government passes a decree to cut the civic militias down. And to Federalists in Zacatecas, this is a huge threat to their state sovereignty. And it becomes a question of almost of states' rights versus the rights of the nation, I guess, the central government. So the state Congress in Zacatecas absolutely refuses to comply with the decree. The civic militia takes up arms, and they basically wait for the central government to come in and attack them, which they do. Santa Anna personally leads the centralist troops into Zacatecas. They completely demolish the resistance and sack the city to send a message to everybody else who would think of challenging their rule.
Now, this song, what's the origin of not only the song but the recording?
The recording is an interesting story. This was something that I was able to pick up in Zacatecas while I was doing my field work there last year. I received a grant with a friend of mine who was also doing a similar music-related project to go to Mexico and conduct field work. My project happened focused on what was happening at this time period on the Mexican side of things. And I was able to meet, while in Zacatecas, a man named Esaul Arteaga, who was a professor of music at the university in Zacatecas there. And he was one of the founding members of a group called Wairapamushka, which means children of the wind in Quechua, coincidentally. They formed this band back in the 1960s, 1970s, to start recording protest music and music from social movements and labor movements and things all throughout Latin America. So they recorded a number of corridos and songs like that. They're the ones who are on this recording interpreting this version of El Corrido de Tata Pachito. Tata Pachito was the affectionate nickname that was given to the former governor of Zacatecas, Francisco Garcia Salinas, who led the civic militia against Santa Anna.
Now, the point of view of this song is?
Is from the people. And that's what I think is interesting about it, because it tells the story that's not found in the official story. In the official story, the Zacatecan militiamen are rebels, are villains, just like the New Mexican rebels. This song, however, is a lament from their point of view, expressing how sorry they feel at seeing their beloved city sacked by the federal troops, and how betrayed they feel by the nation. The first verse is very poetic, and it says, "Ya el águila real voló, y el nopal quedó solito." They're saying that the eagle flew away, and the nopal cactus is left there on its own. And, of course, the eagle on top of the nopal is the symbol of the Mexican nation. So right in the song, you're seeing that the very fabric of the nation is being ripped apart right now by this violence.
So let's hear that song. So that was the song
El Corrido de Tata Pachito, interpreted by Grupo Wairapamushka of Zacatecas, Mexico.
And what's interesting, when you compare those two songs that we heard, the New Mexican version was basically from the point of view of the centralists, and the Zacatecan was from the point of view of the rebels against the centralists, but about this almost the same kind of event in the same time period.
Right. There are different sets of circumstances, of course, different actors. There was no real communication between rebels or anything like that, or even an ideology uniting them. But they both happened as a response to a change in Mexico City.
We're talking to Jonathan Harrell. To what extent is that song kind of living history in Zacatecas?
It's interesting because it's almost unknown at this point. When I first got there and started searching around for it, it took me a while before I was able to find anybody who who had heard of it, much less who could even give me any indication about what it was about or a melody or anything like that. I've yet to find any actual performers. Let me rephrase that. Any non-scholarly performers of music who have that song in their repertoire. It was collected by a renowned corrido scholar in Zacatecas in the 1940s from a very old woman who sang it, and this individual wrote it down and transcribed it. The group Huayrapamushka used his manuscripts to interpret the song, and that's how we have the recording of it. The particular recording was given to me by Esaú Arteaga. I believe the name of the folklorist was called Temo Esparza Sánchez in Zacatecas, who collected it. But it's not really a part of the folk memory anymore at this point that I was able to gather.
So in a way, you're kind of keeping these things alive, at least within scholarly circles, and now in the circles here who listen to the Radio Cafe.
Hopefully.
Yeah. And I guess what the larger theme here is one that's related to language. I mean, I think New Mexico, northern New Mexico, has an image of itself as having Spanish cultural traditions that were basically isolated for a really long time, and that there was a lot of archaic both traditions and linguistic manifestations that are really unrelated to any place else. Mexico moved forward and progressed, and New Mexico kind of stayed in some old fashion. But you have a different perspective on that.
I do. And if you read most of the current scholarship about those things, you'll see that most scholars do as well. And while it's true that we did always have a very isolated culture here and a very isolated communities, we were never as isolated as we might like to think. And when I was in Mexico doing this research, I heard lots of examples of what up until now I believed were just unique happenings of New Mexican Spanish. I heard them in rural areas. I heard them along the coast. I heard them in areas that were themselves isolated from population centers and urban centers. It's been my experience that most of the linguistic features that are characteristic of New Mexican Spanish are also found elsewhere throughout the Spanish-speaking world, but again, in rural communities. And so what we've got here in New Mexico, what we've preserved, what our grandparents and parents have preserved, is not necessarily a unique, distinct, exists only here, somehow pure, intact version of 16th century Castilian Spanish that was deposited here and left here unchanged. What it is it's a very beautiful rural variety of Spanish, and Mexican Spanish specifically, because the Spanish that came here was already thoroughly Americanized in terms of Latin America and Mexicanized in terms of the speakers of Spanish in New Spain, which is, of course, Mexico. And that, of course, has unique linguistic features. Every speech community is going to have its own ways of speaking. No two speech communities are going to be exactly alike. But I would argue that we have more in common with the rural speakers of Latin America than we might like to think so.
Give me an example of that.
Well, a colleague of mine at the university who's from Chile noticed that when she first came here a number of years ago and she started speaking to the older generations in northern New Mexico and hearing their Spanish, she was fascinated because it reminded her so much of the old people in her country in the isolated communities before the main highways were installed, linking them to the rest of the urban centers of the country. And for her, it was a nice reminder of maybe her grandparents' generation, the Spanish that they would speak. And
can
this
you
is
remember,
all the way down in Chile.
Well, can you remember any actual linguistic examples that you could tell maybe the Spanish-speaking people who are listening right now?
Absolutely. Well, New Mexican Spanish is full of really colorful, archaic forms of words. For example, people here say vide instead of vi for the past tense of the verb ver, to see. So instead of saying
I saw, instead of yo vi, be the old form be yo vide.
Yo vide, exactly. They'll say things like yo truje instead of traje for the verb to bring, which is traer. And those are things that you'll find in old Spanish poetry. those were the norm. That was the norm at one time, and it's just become a hangover from that time period. Now, it's easy to point to that as evidence that we speak this kind of intact version of Castilian Spanish. That's probably the wrong direction that you want to go, because, like I said, you'll find the same things all over the place in rural communities. And all of the American Spanish that's spoken in the Latin Americas comes from 16th century Spanish.
So you are walking around rural Chile and somebody says, yo vide and yo truje?
You may hear that. You may hear that. I heard things like that when I was in rural villages in Mexico this past year. I remember being in Jalisco, and we, as soon as we got out of the city, we stopped in this little village to ask directions, and the man said, well, ¿por dónde venites? You know, which route did you come through? And that venites is a regularization of the conjugation veniste, from the verb venir, to come, to arrive, that you hear here all the time. You hear it in small communities all the time. You hear it in small communities in Mexico. You hear, there's a Caribbean version that's even a little more truncated, and they'll say, you know, venites, or venite. Venite, they'll cut off the S at the end of the word. You hear words like asina for así, which means like this. That's an archaism that's held on. But again, you hear that in a lot of different places. One word that really stood out to me is the verb recordar, which to most modern speakers of standard Spanish today, that means to remember. But to rural speakers of the language, it means to wake up. And that's a word that my grandparents used all the time. You know, ya recordó, he woke up. ¿A qué hora recordaste? You know, what time did you wake up?
That's weirdly poetic and metaphorical.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because you're kind of...
Because you forget when you're sleeping, and then when you wake up, you're remembering again your life.
Right. And that was one of those words that growing up, you knew was different from the textbook. You knew it was different from your Spanish class. It was different from your friends from Mexico who spoke a different, more urban version. And when I was in this small town in Jalisco called La Manzanilla, it was right there on the coast, and we went to go visit a very, very old man who was going to tell us some of the history of the town. And he was very old, very sick. He spent a lot of time in bed. And when we got to his house, we asked his daughter, I think, if we could speak to him. And he told us, que no había recordado todavía. He had not woken up yet.
Yeah.
And she used that word, recordar. And I hadn't heard that since my grandparents used it.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, when people here in New Mexico, in northern New Mexico, people like you whose grandparents spoke Spanish, maybe their parents did, maybe they didn't, are learning Spanish really kind of as a second language, kind of not. There's a lot of issues associated with that, which is, do you learn standard Spanish? Do you learn New Mexican Spanish? Do you learn both? Do you learn the distinctions?
Absolutely. And I think you said it right there at the end, as you learn the distinctions. The idea is to become, I think, as educated as you possibly can about whatever it is that you're learning. And if it's language that you're learning, and if it's your heritage language that you're learning, I think you should be as educated as you can about it, because it gives you the tools to talk about it and kind of defend yourself, to defend your way of speaking, to defend your community's way of speaking to people who may be less educated about your language than you are. And that's been a struggle throughout New Mexico's history, I think, especially after statehood and with the implementation of public education. It's been very difficult. First of all, people were punished for even speaking Spanish. You didn't want to speak Spanish at one time. That was part of that big assimilation process. And so you've got this generation, at least a couple of generations of loss, who have really experienced a traumatic language loss, and that's affected the present generation. There's a lot of kids who don't speak the language anymore, who lament the fact that they don't speak it anymore, who go and take a Spanish as a heritage language class, and thinking that they might be the only person with that experience, and when they get there, they realize that just about everybody in that class has had the same story of trauma, of loss. And so now what you have is you have a generation of students who maybe didn't grow up speaking the language. They grew up with their grandparents speaking it, or their parents. They were they spoke a little bit, maybe. And they're interested in learning it. They want to learn about their culture and their language. And so they go and take classes. And then they end up hitting a wall, because they see a textbook printed in Spain or Mexico or some urban center of the Spanish-speaking world. They see a Spanish which is very different from what they're used to speaking at home. And what they're realizing, but they might not know at the time, is they're what they're experiencing. I mean, is the shock that comes from speaking a stigmatized variety of a language, really, and trying to learn the standard version of that language, which could almost be described as a sort of a foreign language or a foreign dialect.
And at the same time, it's going to be easier for them to learn standard Spanish than for somebody else who's never spoken any Spanish. And the potential for connection to Latin American and Spanish people is a wonderful possibility.
I believe so. Unfortunately, sometimes it's not always that easy. And so what happens to a lot of kids who get into these classes, they see that the Spanish they speak is so different from what's spoken in the book. Oftentimes, the instructor might not have any consciousness of their particular linguistic experience, and so they're made to feel ashamed of their variety. First of all, they're made to feel ashamed that they don't speak it. Then they're made to feel ashamed of what little Spanish they do speak, and so it's a very high hill to climb.
I was once, when I very first started learning Spanish many years ago, I went to a Spanish language class. I took one semester at the Santa Fe Community College, had a wonderful teacher, and there was a New Mexican man in there who, the past tense of to go, he's tu fuiste, and he said, no, it's not tu fuiste, it's tu fuites. Mm-hmm. And the teacher said, well, actually, the standard is tu fuiste. And what was interesting about that interaction wasn't, oh, that's the Spanish, that's the New Mexican, but there was an emotional charge and a kind of sense of anger that his Spanish wasn't considered right. And I think that this whole movement toward heritage Spanish grew from that.
Absolutely. And I think it's a very good result of all of that. It's unfortunate that conflict arose in that class in the way that it arose, but I think it was a great teachable moment, and it was good for the teacher to explain the difference between those two forms. And I also understand the frustration of the student that you're talking about in insisting that no, his form is correct. And he's absolutely right. His form is correct. His form is correct for his speech community. And the standard written that the instructor was showing is the correct form for standard written Spanish. And that's when you get into those differences between the varieties.
And honestly, we have that same thing in English. There are many dialects of English that have their own beauty and poetry, and we have Spanglish here. And as the late, great David Foster Wallace wonderfully pointed out, it's in everybody's interest who's an English speaker to learn standard written English, because you will not get by in life if you want to have a professional life if you don't learn standard written English. But also knowing your own dialect is equally important, and the same goes for Spanish.
Absolutely. And what's interesting here in New Mexico is standard English has sort of taken the place of the formal public language here in New Mexico. And so in some instances, people don't see the need to learn the standard Spanish because most of their public discourse, their formal discourse, will take place in English. When they go to the bank or when they go see a judge or something like that, those situations are communicated in English, and the local dialect of Spanish is reserved for the home, for the community, for the family, and that is absolutely the correct form to be using. In fact, you might be criticized for speaking standard written Spanish in that home environment, as I was, as several people were. When I was taking grammar classes, I'd go home and say something, and my uncle would correct me and say I was wrong. Well, I'd go back to the class, and I'd use the word my uncle said, and then the teacher would correct me there. And
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Harrell is a scholar specializing in Mexican and New Mexican history and language. He's a teacher of heritage language, and he'll be speaking at the conference of the Rocky Mountain Council for Latin American Studies. Now, you are speaking on the conference is running from the 6th through the 9th. You'll be speaking on the 8th of April on the very things that we just heard, these songs and so on.
Right. I'll be focusing on the rebellion of 1837 here in New Mexico and the battle of 1835 in Zacatecas, and the ballads and the poetry that came out of those two events.
Well, for more information, how can people find out more about the conference?
Well, they can visit the conference website, the council's website, www.rmclas.org. That's RMCLAS, Rocky Mountain Council for Latin American Studies.
And I'll link to that on my website, too. Jonathan Harrell, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.